This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and once again I hope to tell you some interesting things about the tulip. As I said last time, the tulip really originated as a native plant in Turkey. And if you think about Turkish gardens and the environment like those of the Mughals, the gardens were intimate. By laying a rug in the wilderness, the first gardens were created by nomadic Turks. Later, when they cultivated flowers, it naturally followed. In such a waterless land, trees should be planted to shade the flowers. Walls were then needed to protect the trees, and more walls to protect the harem. Within these sanctuaries, water was also used for its assuaging sound as it sprang from small fountains, or for its gentle motion continually falling from scalloped basin to basin. Beds of scented flowers and roses, twining climbers, carvings, and scrolls all created that same floral privacy as in the Mughal gardens. And there was one distinctive feature of the Ottoman garden, the kiosk, a small roofed pavilion, often decorated with mother of pearl and gilding, and hung with paintings of fruits and flowers. Descriptions of these kiosks from travelers in other centuries sound too delectable, with their places for reclining and their splashing water from interior marble fountains. Contemplation and inactivity could last for hours. Imagine, there is no doubt that just to read about or to look at pictures of them is to be aware of the immediate and enviable charm that is intrinsically their own. One legacy from 16th century Turkey for which we must ever be thankful is the tulip. In Michael Pollan's The Botany of Desire, he talks about three plants that he thinks have changed the world. The first is the apple, as you think about Johnny Appleseed, for example. The second he writes about is the tulip, and the third is marijuana. But in his discussion of the tulip, he talks about it as an almost archetypal image in our mind. If you say tulip, we visualize it. And I sort of demonstrated this for myself. Yesterday, I was asked to give a program for a women's literary group, and I decided to take paper and crayons and ask them to draw a tulip. And of course, what they came up with different variations, was the image of the tulip with its little pointed petals. But I wonder what the sort of flower that children draw if they're not drawing daisies. But what did children draw before the tulip? The word tulip is a corruption of the Turkish word for turban. The fact that the tulip's first official trip west took it from one court to another, that it was a flower favored by royalty, may also have contributed to its quick ascendancy, for court fashions have always been especially catching. The tulips is not a case where the plant had to travel the world before its virtues could be recognized at home. By the time of the emperor's consignment, the tulip had already had its own cult of admirers in the East, who had taken the flower a considerable distance from its form in the wild. In other words, when it's growing in the wild in Turkey, it typically appears as a short, pretty, cheerful flower, frank, open-faced, six-petaled star, often with a dramatic splotch of contrasting color at the base. Species tulips in Turkey typically come in red, less commonly in white or yellow. The Ottoman Turks had discovered that these wild tulips were great changelings, freely hybridizing, though it takes 7 years before a tulip grown from seed flowers and shows its new colors. But also, it's subject to mutations that produce spontaneous and wonderful changes in form and color. The tulip's mutability was taken as a sign that nature cherished this flower above all others. In his 1597 herbal, John Girard says of the tulip that, quote, "Nature seems to play more with this flower than with any other that I do know." The tulip's genetic variability has in fact given nature, or more precisely, natural selection, a great deal to play with. From among the chance mutations thrown out by a flower, nature preserves the rare ones that confer some advantage, brighter color, more perfect symmetry, whatever. For millions of years, such features were selected, in effect, by the tulip's pollinators, that is, insects, until the Turks came along and began to cast their own votes. The Turks did not learn to make deliberate crosses till the 1600s. The novel tulips they prized were simply said to have occurred. Darwin called such a process artificial as opposed to natural selection. But from the flower's point of view, this is a distinction without a difference. Individual plants in which a trait desired either by bees or Turks occurred wound up with more offspring. Though we self-importantly regard domestication as something people have done to plants, it is at the same time a strategy by which plants have exploited us and our desires, even our most idiosyncratic notions of beauty, to advance their own interests. In the environment of the Ottoman Empire, the best way for a tulip to get ahead was to have absurdly long petals drawn to a point fine as a needle. In drawings, paintings, and ceramics, these elongated blossoms look as though they'd been stretched to the limit by a glass blower. Those words scarcely convey the actuality and strangeness of these tulips prized by the Turks. And so I suggest that you go to the UPR website, and Brian Earle will make a picture from Anna Pivard's book of these elongated tulips. You wouldn't believe it unless you look up the pictures. When the tulip first arrived in Europe, people set about fashioning some utilitarian purpose for it. The Germans boiled and sugared the bulbs and unconvincingly declared them a delicacy. The English tried serving them up with oil and vinegar. Pharmacists proposed the tulip as a remedy for flatulence. None of these caught on, however. It finally became simply the tulip's beauty that made a good match for the Dutch temperament. Generally bereft of scent, the tulip is the coolest of floral characters. In fact, the Dutch counted the tulip's lack of scent as a virtue, a proof of the flower's chasteness and moderation. Petals curving inward to hide its sexual organs, the tulip is an introvert among flowers. It is also somewhat aloof, one bloom per stem, one stem per plant. The tulip allows us to admire it. One crucial element of beauty of the tulip that intoxicated the Dutch, the Turks, the French, and the English has been lost to us. To them, the tulip was a magic flower because it was prone to spontaneous and brilliant eruptions of color. In the planting of 100 tulips, one of them might be so possessed, opening to reveal the white or yellow of its petals painted as if by the finest brush and steadiest hand, with intricate feathers or flames vividly contrasting hues. As I said last time, the tulip was said to have broken, and if a tulip broke in a particularly striking manner, if the flames of the applied color reached clear to the petal's lip and its pigment brilliant and pure and its pattern symmetrical, the owner of the bulb had won the lottery, so he thought. Anna Pivard, in her book, The Tulip, recounts the extraordinary lengths to which Dutch growers would go to make their tulips break, sometimes borrowing their techniques from alchemists who faced what must have been a comparable challenge. Over the earth, above a bed planted with white tulips, gardeners would liberally sprinkle paint powders of the desired hue on the theory that rainwater would wash the color down to the roots, where it would be taken up by the bulbs. Charlatans sold recipes believed to produce magic color breaks. Pigeon droppings were thought to be an effective agent, as was plaster dust taken from walls of old houses. Unlike the alchemists, whose attempts to change base metals into gold reliably failed, now and then would-be tulip changers would be rewarded with a good break, inspiring everybody to redouble their efforts. What the Dutch could not have known was that a virus was responsible for the magic of the broken tulip. a fact that as soon as it was discovered, doomed the beauty it had made possible. The color of a tulip actually consists of two pigments working in concert, a base color that is always yellow or white, and a second, laid-on color that is a mix of two hues, determines the unitary color we see. This virus works partially and irregularly, suppressing the anthocyanin, thereby allowing a portion of underlying color to show through. It wasn't until the 1920s, after the invention of the electron microscope, that scientists discovered the virus was being spread from tulip to tulip by the peach potato aphid. I thought that I would give you just an idea of how things were when the bottom dropped out of the tremendous tulip success in Holland. This is from a book called Tulipomania by Mike Dash. The collapse of the tulip trade after February 3rd was so complete that virtually no information survived concerning the sort of prices paid for bulbs in the spring of 1637. It would appear the only buyers left in the market were the connoisseurs and perhaps a few rich florists who were not entirely dependent on flowers for their wealth, and that only the rarest and most superbly fine varieties had a chance at all of being sold. According to one contemporary, a tulip that had been worth 5,000 guilders before the crash was sold for 50 guilders. In May, a bed of tulips that may have fetched 600 to 1,000 guilders in January is said to have changed hands for 6 guilders. So this was a terrible crash. Of course, if you were to go to Amsterdam in the spring now, you would see that the tulip is back and thriving. But at that time, it was a phenomenal rise to fame and then a phenomenal fall. There's so much that you could learn about the tulip, and I suggest that you do some research of your own and that you enjoy tulips wherever they might be this spring. I'm told that Red Butte Gardens outside of Salt Lake is ablaze with daffodils and tulips, also Thanksgiving Point. And if you have an opportunity, do as I plan to do and visit one of those two places or both of them. So this is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.